Good morning, Your Honors. My name is William Manning. I'm with the firm of Saul Ewing, and I represent the appellant in this case, Lewis Investment Company. I'd like to introduce to the court two colleagues who are here with me today, my partner Jim Taylor and our associate Nicole Olling. May it please the court, regarding the party's real estate agreement, the court below found that neither party was prepared to perform on the date set by Lewis Investment's lawyer's letter, that date being late August, August 24, I think it was, 2006. That finding is not challenged on appeal. In other words, Lewis Investment has chosen not to quarrel with the lower court's factual finding that both parties, including Lewis Investment, was not prepared to close on August 24, 2006. And the effect of our tactical decision not to challenge a fact finding made below is to essentially say that rescission is the best we can do. In order to get damages for breach of contract, we'd have to persuade the court that that finding was erroneous, and that's a mountain we've simply chosen not to climb.
Can I interrupt right there?
Yes.
I saw something, unless I was misreading it, that indicated that you waived your argument, your rescission claim, in the trial court. Is that incorrect?
It is correct that that argument is made. That argument is incorrect. We did not waive the claim for rescission. The source, the part of the record to which my friend cites in supporting that argument that we waived or abandoned the claim for rescission is the pretrial order. Now, the pretrial order explains to the court what we're seeking. And the first two elements in that list of things that we're seeking describe perfectly rescissory damages in this case. We say that in that pretrial order, and I'm quoting from memory, but I can get it in front of me if Your Honors prefer. The first element that we seek is the return of the deposit made in that case.
That would be the $850,000.
Your Honor, it would be $650,000. That was the deposit. The next articulated item is the return of payments made for extensions. Another $150,000. So the two of them combined would be $800,000. And that perfectly describes what I will call rescissory damages in this case. The next thing described to the trial court were reimbursement for expenses incurred in the
out-of-pocket.
Out-of-pocket expenses.
$130,000.
Yes, sir. We believe that that's the difference. We are no longer entitled to seek...
Well, here's my problem.
Yes,
let's assume that you're right, your side is right, and that rescission should have been the remedy. I can understand if you're restoring the status quo, but only insofar as the contract required a down payment or a deposit of $650,000. The $150,000, which were the payments for the extension, were payments for performance that you received. And the out-of-pockets were done in connection with your sides contemplating that both sides would perform.
Yes, sir.
And while both sides were proceeding to do that. So my bottom line question is, aren't you overreaching by trying to obtain more than the $650,000?
Well, perhaps I've been confusing, and if so, I apologize. My point that I'm making is that we cannot get the out-of-pockets. In other words, by abandoning our claim for a breach of contract, and we're abandoning it because we choose not to assault appeal the fact-finding made below that we were not prepared to close, given that we couldn't claim breach. And so if breach is out of the case, then so too are claims for reimbursement of those out-of-pocket expenses. Now, Your Honor has also suggested that I should also lose the $150,000 paid for extensions.
I'm suggesting that you should explain why you shouldn't lose when you already received, contract or no contract, the quid pro quo for that $150,000.
Your Honor, the contract requires it as an additional deposit, and because we regard it as an additional deposit, we put it in the same category of rescissory damages as the initial deposit. But I take Your Honor's point, and I take it then that Your Honor and I would agree that rescission would at least entitle my client to the return of $650,000 plus interest.
Well, I'm not agreeing or disagreeing. I'm just asking questions. So are you conceding that the other two elements are not part of your rescission claim, or are you still in the case?
I feel, Your Honor, it would be unfair of me to say, no, that middle bit of damages should be lumped in with rescissory damages when I haven't briefed it. And since Your Honor has raised it and challenged me on that, I have to say I have to concede, because I have no authority for Your Honor this morning to suggest that that should be part of rescissory damages. We included it as part of we believed, as we briefed this case to the court, that that would be included in rescission because it was an additional deposit under the contract.
So I won't be confused.
Yes, sir.
Is what's at stake now the $650,000?
Plus interest, yes, sir.
Period.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Your Honor, did I answer your question about whether or not we abandoned our claim for rescission? I don't think we did, and we've explained why. I think that the pretrial order to which my friend refers perfectly articulates, A, the element of damages that would be regarded as rescissory, and because at that time we were seeking more, it made sense to articulate what additional elements of damages we would we saw it before the trial court. Your Honors are familiar with the contest between appellee and appellant in this case. For reasons that I don't know, the court below in deciding this case raised the question in its own mind, is a party who seeks to declare time of the essence, and we're talking about a contract in which time has not been made of the essence by express terms of the agreement, is a party who seeks to change that status and make time of the essence entitled to do so regardless of whether it is ready to perform at the time it makes its demand? Professor Williston has articulated three sets of circumstances under which a party may make time of the essence, even though the contract doesn't say so. The court below considered the first two listed by Professor Williston and simply stopped reading. It is that third set of circumstances that we think apply in this case.
Let me interrupt here. As I understand it, you're saying that if one side sets a deadline, then the time of setting that deadline is not relevant for determining the ability to execute the agreement or the ability to carry out that side's obligations, right?
Except insofar as it triggers a period which has to be reasonable.
Okay, fine.
Other than that, let
me stop you. Ooh.
Yes.
So your side says 30 days and we want the deal to be closing, right?
Perform, yes.
Okay. But at the time you make that demand, you don't have the financial resources to pay what's required at closing, and I gather that's undisputed, right?
It is,
okay.
And we have not challenged that.
Okay, fine. Now, here's my question. Under this third standard, don't you have to be able to perform at the end of 30 days? In other words, can one side say, okay, we're making time of the essence, you have to be able to perform in 30 days. 30 days comes and goes, you still haven't cleared the title problem, therefore you're not able to perform, doesn't matter that we can't perform either.
Yes, it does.
Okay.
And that's exactly why there is another set of circumstances. And there's nothing wrong with the notion that a party not able to perform at the time it makes a demand, nevertheless, makes time of the essence. Because if that time for performance applies to both parties.
Well, Mr. Manning, let me just see if I have this right. Does this appeal turn on how this court decides to interpret one sentence in a treatise that was written by Professor Williston 100 years ago?
Yes.
Okay.
It turns on whether there's any authority for the proposition that a party in Lewis Investments' position had to be ready, willing, and able to close at the time it demanded performance from its counterparty.
Your argument is that, if you're proceeding from Williston as the rule of law, you know, Professor Williston is a law professor, not a legislator, and not a judge. So there has to be some other, I would assume, some other basis for coming up with a principle that seems to be counterintuitive, at least in terms of fundamental principles of contract law. But before you respond to that, let's step back for a minute.
Make sure I do respond, Your Honor.
I will.
It's the centerpiece of this case.
Okay. But I'm trying to locate where that centerpiece is. Are we really talking about principles of equitable remedies here, or are we still in contract land?
No, this is equity. This is
not contract land.
Equity says that where nobody is ready to perform, the parties get waived off and each gets returned to that party they came to the table.
If we're talking about general principles of equity, totally apart from principles of contract law, then you're trying to sneak in through the back door, you know, what is a principle of contract law, are you not?
No, because I think while the contract was in effect, a party...
I meant no disrespect by phrasing the question that way.
none taken, Your Honor. While the contract was in effect, we have to look to principles of contract law to determine how one can make time of the essence. I'd like to respond to your Honor's earlier point. Because you suggested that the notion for which I'm contending is counterintuitive. I saw that when I first pondered this question, and I've concluded it's not. And here's why. A contract is adrift. There is no time for closing. Nobody seems to be ready to close today. And a party says, I want an end to it. And follows the standards and meets the circumstances prescribed by Professor Williston and sets a reasonable time and says, if performance doesn't happen on this reasonable time, the contract is over. Why is it unreasonable, unfair, or intuitively incorrect, to use Your Honor's phrase, for that demand to prevail? If that party, the demanding party, isn't ready to perform, and the other party is, the demanding party's in breach. The other party gets full remedies for breach. If neither is ready to perform, then the time for performance is come and gone, and both parties are entitled to take what they brought to the party and leave. And so I would suggest to Your Honor that this rule crafted by Professor Williston, or articulated by Professor Williston, and I understand we're talking only about a law professor, but this is the authority chosen by the lower court. We are in a defensive posture below. We are responding to exceptions taken by our friends to the master's ruling. Our friends did not support, with any legal authority, the notion that one who is not able to perform at the time he makes a demand cannot make time of the essence. We don't think that's true. Professor Williston doesn't think it's true. And the trial court relied on Professor Williston.
Well, we don't really know what Professor Williston thought because we're dealing with a portion of a sentence in a treatise that may or may not have been amended by his later editors.
Well, Your Honor,
it may be loose language for all we know.
I apologize. I didn't mean to interrupt. Your Honor, we read guidance all the time, whether it's in a statute, whether it's in a case, or whether it's in a treatise, or whether it's in a law review article.
So there's nothing in any ALI restatement or in any Delaware case that supports Professor Williston?
That is correct, but let me put it another way. He who is asserting that we were disqualified from declaring time to be of the essence has not cited any authority for the proposition that our state of readiness matters at all.
You're into your rebuttal time, which you're welcome to use or not.
Unless the court has questions at this time, I'd prefer to save it. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Honorable Justices of the Delaware Supreme Court, I am Craig Karsnitz, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to allow me to appear here today to argue this case on behalf of my clients, the Graves family.
Let me start out with more or less what we left off with. What is wrong with the general proposition that if you have a contract that has no apparent ending date, and one side decides let's either do it or be done with it, and says, okay, in 30 days either we go to closing or we call it quits, what's wrong with the idea that the party who makes that, adds that requirement, if you will, if that party is unable to perform in 30 days, then the other side gets damages? Why is that not an appropriate way to look at the situation?
Your Honor, two reasons. First of all, even the provision in Williston cited by my honorable colleague does not stand for that proposition. And the second reason is that where you do not have a time is of the essence clause in the contract, then parties have reasonable time. And in this case, a finding of the lower court was that the time that was taken by the Graves family to cure this problem was a reasonable time under the circumstances of this contract. So there was still a contractual relation between the parties. My client got to the point where they were in compliance and able to perform, and they were not. And if I could, at Justice Jacobs, this had an extended discussion of this provision of Williston. If you look at the provision itself, and it was cited in their brief, and I have it here in front of me, it said, talking of time of the essence, it may also be made of the essence by one of the parties fixing a reasonable time for the completion of the contract. That means performance. So what we had in the late summer and early fall of 2006 was neither party was able to perform at that time. There's no question about that. We don't challenge that. They don't challenge that. But the parties still had a contractual relationship. And they had my client had a reasonable time to perform, and they had a reasonable time to perform. My client did perform. They demanded that the case go to the transaction went to settlement. They refused to, and they were in breach of contract. And as a result, my client was entitled to contractual damages as set forth in the contract, which is what the court below found.
Okay, but your client didn't perform until 5 or 6 months after
correct.
The 30-day deadline, if you will.
That's correct.
And why is that a factual finding that that we have to defer to? Isn't that a question of law as to what is a reasonable time?
I would suggest, Your Honor, it's probably a mixed question of fact and law. There are a lot of facts. Court below did an extended analysis of what was reasonable and what happened in this case at pages 44 through 47 of its decision, and determined that based on its view of the facts of this case, that was a reasonable time. And I would point out to you, Your Honor, there were a number of factors that went into that. This was not a standard real estate contract of a home where you expect to go to settlement in a few months. This contract was already over 2 years old when this all happened. And, in fact, Mr. Stout, the principal of the appellant, had told my clients he can't even be ready to go to settlement, perhaps until early in 2007. That's what he told. He said that they had some discussions with financing people, and in those discussions they were not going to be able to do it until 2007.
Okay, so let me stop you there.
Yes.
Let's assume, as I think you're trying to drive at, let's assume that the other side decided this is getting too difficult, we're not getting the approvals we need, it's taking too long, it's become too expensive, we want to just get out of this, all right? And they chose a method to try and get out by saying, let's set a firm deadline, 30 days. And all your client had to do to be able to put them in breach is clear that title problem within 30 days. Was that not doable? I mean, as a matter of fact, is there anything in the record that indicates that 30 days would not be long enough to do that?
The answer to that question is no. And in fact, we had evidence that if this issue, if we believed they were really serious about a date, we could have done it. We presented an attorney that was a title expert, and he said if you have to do a stop everything and get this done, you could file a petition for partition in the Court of Chancery and ask the court to allow the sale to go forward and the money be escrowed. There would have been methods to do that. But one of our points
Wait a second. How did your clients do it ultimately? Did they file a petition for partition?
No, ultimately my clients contacted the we were talking about a 1/8 interest.
I understand.
In 3+ acres of this property. Ultimately, they located and determined who the people were that had that interest,
right,
and they bought it from them. They paid, about $80,000 to do
that. How long did that take?
The paperwork was finalized in either the end of December or early January of 2007, and Mr. Smith, that was handling the transaction, notified the appellants in early February 2007.
That's not really the question,
not
in my mind. When was the effort made to locate the owner? You know, give me a starting date for that, and when was the owner located? How much time passed doing that? And then how much longer before a sale was able to be agreed upon?
It became clear in June to my clients, to the Graves, and I think Mr. William Graves testified about this, that this had to be done, and he started his process to locate. These were extended family members that he was looking for. And he worked through the summer, located the parties. Two of the people were able to resolve this very quickly with. There was one party that the negotiations were extended. But I believe they reached agreement in late fall of 2006, and paperwork was put together and finalized by sometime in December or January.
Well, actually, it took more than 30 days.
It did. And this was subject of discussion and testimony at the trial. I asked Mr. Smith, did you drop everything? No, because and the reason was they didn't believe that they had an obligation, and they did not believe that
believe they had an obligation to drop everything.
Right.
But the import of the opinion, at least as I read it, was that if they did, they were acting under the belief that they had to drop everything, they could have gotten it done in 30 days.
Correct. I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And as I said, we presented evidence to that effect.
Okay. This is all a factual issue. I'd like to get back to the legal issue, and unfortunately, in return to Professor Williston for a moment. As I understand it, the Williston, you know, basically in his treatise proposed three scenarios.
Yes.
Where a party to a contract can make time of the essence. And we're focusing on the third. The first two require the ability, you know, that the parties be able and willing to perform. The third doesn't use those words. Mr. Manning interprets that omission to mean that there doesn't have to be, the parties, his client did not have to be ready, willing, and able to perform. All it had to do was to dictate a time deadline. I gather your response, but I want to make sure I have it right, is that the ability and willingness to perform is implicit in that third scenario by the professor's use of the word performance, correct?
And use of the word completion of the
completion,
contract.
Completion,
excuse me. Yes, correct.
Okay. And if I understood Mr. Manning's brief correctly, his rejoinder to that was, well, then Professor Williston has basically come up with a third scenario that's redundant of the other two.
My response to that is I don't think that's correct. I think the third scenario is a slightly different scenario, but I really think what he's doing with these three scenarios is applying the same law to slightly different facts.
Okay, well, I mean, there one response is, yeah, you may be right, but so what? Right. You know, it's a treatise, not a statute. But you're saying, well, it actually, we really should pause over that and try to parse it out?
Well, I have to in response to the argument that's being made, but I agree with Your Honor that this court is not bound by what's written in a treatise. Now, certainly, Vice Chancellor Glasscock relied upon this, and I think it sets forth appropriate law.
Tell us why it's not redundant. I interrupted you.
Because, Your Honor, it deals with a slightly different factual situation and applies what I believe is the same law as is applied to all three. It may also be made in the sense of where one party fixes a reasonable time for the completion of the contract and gives notice to the other party of an intention to abandon. It's just a slightly different factual situation. And one of the things I wanted to point out to the court, that if you look just a few pages after that, the next page in Williston, about three sentences later, says, and this is speaking generically of a notice to make time of the essence. The notice binds not only the party upon whom it is served, but also the party serving it. The party serving it must perform within the time stated or thereafter be unable to require counterperformance.
What's the cite to that?
That's the very same section of Williston that the previous provision was. It's 46-16. It's just a couple of lines later than the section that Mr. Manning was discussing. The second half of what I wanted to just discuss with this court is there's an argument being made that, well, these parties were kind of in a never-never land, and somehow something has to happen. Well, that's correct. And that gets into the question that we were discussing a bit ago, and that is what, under the circumstances of this case, was a reasonable time. And I would suggest when we look at the reasonable time, we're not looking at how long is it going to take us to do something. We're looking at, under the circumstances, when would it be appropriate for us or any party to perform.
And well, can I stop you there? Because I get the sense, and I could be wrong on this, but my overall picture here is that one side wants to do a big development. It's becoming expensive, drawn out, perhaps not worth the time, effort, and money. The other side knows that they've got a title problem and has known it for 2 years or more, but doesn't want to spend the money to clear that title unless it has to or they have to. So to a certain extent, you're at the end game, and the question is only going to be, are there going to be contract damages for breach, or is there going to be rescission? And your client decided to wait and see and didn't spend the money to clear the title because that would have been money that would basically be thrown out. I guess they'd have good title, that's something. But they didn't want to spend that money if the deal wasn't going to go through. So they wait until the other side sues, and then they say, okay, now we know that they were serious, so now we'll clear the title.
Your Honor, I think your facts are a little bit wrong.
Okay.
In that. They gave the effort to clear the title, the haste that was demanded of them by the Lewis Investment. Lewis Investment was saying, we don't want to settle on this for 2 years. I don't think it's also fair to say that they didn't want to spend the money. Sooner or later, they were going to have to clear title no matter what they were going to do. It was one of these things that has to be done. But they just didn't do the drop everything and get it done now. And it was clear before they were sued, and it was clear, and demand to settle was made, and the response to the demand to settle was the lawsuit. So that was the factual scenario of what we had. And as I said, Vice Chancellor Glasscock spent about 4 pages of the decision analyzing all of the facts and circumstances of this case, as he was required to do under the Bryant decision, which talks about what happens when you have this kind of problem and what is a reasonable time. And his conclusion was that this was reasonable. And again, I think we need to keep in mind what was happening here and what was being said by the parties, what was being said by Mr. Stout. Mr. Stout was saying, I can't settle for the earliest until sometime in early 2007. That's what he told them at the September 2006 meeting that he had with all the parties involved and was taped and that you have the transcript of and you can see what he said. But his view at that point was, we can settle, but it won't happen until 2007. And another specific finding of the court was that Mr. Stout and his partner, Mr. Teague, that attended that meeting, believed that the contract was continuing and intended to have the contract to continue. That was also a finding that the trial court made in this case. Those are the comments I would have. The only other thing I would like to say, only because I think I need to respond on behalf of my clients, there was an argument made that somehow the damages in this case are a windfall to my client. My client's property was tied up for many years, and ultimately they had a $13 million contract that didn't settle. So I suppose a windfall is in the eye of the beholder, but certainly it's not a windfall. It's contract damages.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'll apologize to the court and Mr. Karsnitz. I did not see in his brief the statement to which he is referred in front of this court. I don't believe my client said we cannot settle until 2007. My client said we would rather settle in 2007. And all of the negotiations about what my client thought was a new deal had settlement off into the future. But don't want to and can't are very different things. More importantly, you've just learned that the reason why the Graves family was entitled to ignore the demand for closing in 30 days is it because the Graves didn't believe that my client, Lewis Investment, was serious. Serious is the word chosen by Mr. Carter.
Right, and the court found that it wasn't serious, not in those terms, but that despite this verbal admonition that they should settle by July, whatever the date was, that your client was then proceeding to act completely inconsistently with any notion that was a deadline which, if not met, would result in dire consequences. I mean, you've got a factual finding that's an obstacle to your argument. What is your response?
The fact finding was that when Lewis Investment made the demand 30 days when Lewis Investment made the demand on July, I'll say 25th, it wasn't ready to close then. And the court also believed simply because my client had asked for extensions that it couldn't have closed in August, the date set. My point about this claim of seriousness is as follows. Where a party has fears, reasonable fears, that his counterparty or her counterparty cannot close at the appointed time, the law prescribes a course of conduct that was never taken in this case. If you and I are headed for a closing and I don't want to expend money getting ready to close because I don't think you're going to close, I can ask for reasonable assurances. And that was not done. It is interesting what wasn't said in the letter that responded to Mr. Tatusco's first letter. No one said on behalf of the Graves family, I'm sorry, give us a little more time, 30 days isn't enough. No one said, well, wait a minute, Lewis Investment, we don't think that you're ready, so tell us, give us reasonable assurances that indeed this is a date on which you could close. Instead, the letter ignores altogether the inability of the seller to close. So you have this interesting situation where there's been speculation, which we're not challenging, that one party is not ready to close. It is dead certain that the other party is not ready to close, and yet that party is the party who is being awarded contract damages in this case. And I understand that the rule for which I contend may initially be thought to be counterintuitive, but it makes perfect sense where a contract's adrift, neither party seems ready to perform. There's nothing wrong with one party saying, let's set a date. Here's the date. Tell me if it's not reasonable, but if it's reasonable, let's set a date. If I'm not ready, you get breach of damages. If I am ready and you're not, I will get breach of damages. Let's put an end to this. And that's exactly what happened in this case. And I will simply close by saying what I said at the end of my remarks. If there's a party at risk for lack of authority in this case, I submit to you that the party who bears the risk is the party who is asserting that this element, readiness to close, is a precondition of making a demand, making time of the essence. There is no authority for that proposition.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
We appreciate the arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and take a brief recess.